Now Cosmo Kentish-Barnes is taking us to North Canterbury. He's with self-taught farmer and grower Phil Varley. They're at the Pihi Farms property Phil owns with his partner, Catherine Campbell.
We're just above...
Oh, actually, sorry, I didn't press record. I've done a whole interview like that.
So you should have just recorded when you rocked up. That would have been easier, isn't it?
Now, Phil, can you tell me where we are and a bit about the land and when you first came here?
Yep, sure. So we're in the hills above Manuka Bay, which is just about 10 minutes southeast of Cheviot, halfway between Christchurch and Kaikoura on the east coast. And we got this place about 3 years ago now, and we didn't really actively manage it for the first 6 months or so. It had been lease grazed and pretty abused landscape for probably about 20 odd years before we came along, and we just wanted to give it a little bit of time to rest. And yep. So we kind of had about 8 to 10 months of just letting it go fallow and seeing what happened. And then we kind of slowly got ourselves up here and started getting ourselves established and tapped an area so we could get in and start doing some gardening and growing a few little things too, and then started getting some livestock and a bit more actively managing the property and then seeing how we could use those animals to just improve the landscape.
And how many hectares have you got in
total? We're just over 20 hectares, so about 50 acres in old money.
And it's quite steep rolling country.
Yep. These rolling parts are really manageable, and then the steeper stuff you need to take a wee bit more care and attention in what you're doing, particularly with the livestock.
And that steep part goes down to a big pine plantation.
So we've got our neighbour's forestry block next door that's about 90 hectares of pines that just go over a few hills and ridges there, and we're really fortunate to be able to actively manage that as well, so we have an agreement to graze that too. So that's really handy for summer and winter grazing, to be perfectly honest, somewhere that's sheltered and warm in winter, and then a bit of shade in summer. It's really important for particularly the cattle.
Now, you've got your caravan perched on the highest point of the land.
Yep, it's a pretty neat spot. We're really well sheltered from the northeasterly here, which is the persistent cold wind, and so these pines provide us a lot of protection. But we are really exposed to the nor'wester, which can barrel through, and so that's why we do have a bit of shelter up, and we have planted trees along the end of the ridge before it drops away there, just to provide us that shelter. But as it is in Canterbury, nothing grows that quick without water, particularly trees, so it'll take a wee while, but I'm sure we can enhance the microclimate we've got.
And eventually, would you like to build a house here?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll build here one day. Probably on this spot is where we're thinking. That's why we originally came with a caravan. We wasn't sure. A bit of a tricky piece of land to kind of design and work around, so it was just to be able to come here and move around and just experience the landscape, the weather, and just figure out kind of where is the optimal place from an energy perspective and time, and then money as well.
You've already established quite a large market garden here.
Yeah, it's pretty intensive, and we're just reorientating the beds at the minute, so there's not a lot in there now. But the main things we grow kind of fit in with the whole farm system that we've got, which, because the livestock are the bulk of our income, and do take quite a bit of time to manage in terms of how we do that, the veg production space has really got to work around that. And so we grow crops that are kind of pop in the ground and we kind of set and forget. And so
easy care,
low maintenance, and so we'll take out probably almost a third of our growing space with garlic, so that's quite a big thing what we grow. Then we also grow tewa, Maori potatoes is the other thing that's a chunk of what we grow, and again that we can plant them in September, and then we don't harvest those till April, which gives them a real opportunity to get nice and big. And I can show you some of the different varieties we've got there, really unusual, highly nutritious and just a delight to eat, eh?
Let's go and have a look.
Yeah, sure. And then also we grow, in the sense of those tubers, Jerusalem artichokes, which we've just taken the tops off here now. And then another unusual one this far south in New Zealand would be yakon, which is another tuber, but a very sweet, almost pear-like texture. And that's really quite popular as well.
Ah, now what's in this
container
here? So
here's just a little selection of some of the things we grow. So this is Erinichia, a purple potato. These are a long cylinder shape with a little nodes on them, and I kind of describe them as purple poos. And this is White Porapora, which is a purple and white mottled potato.
It's quite big.
Yeah. I think in terms of all the ones we produce, they tend to look quite big, and that's what kind of the chefs that we work with kind of say, that they generally don't see them coming in this size from anywhere else, and I think that's part of the how we manage the soil and part of that long growing season. They are quite resilient. If you can, I guess, get good seed stock and then look after that, they can be really easy care, really prolific in a really low input environment, which is kind of what we're after, you know. And the other side of that is when I kind of learnt about the history of them and the meaning and how they're literally seen as taonga, I think as a treasure, it's appealed to me quite a lot. And so I've just wanted to kind of continue this heritage, really, and see how we can improve the seed stock available, because there's a lot of them out there that are susceptible to a lot of pests and diseases. And so I think if we can concentrate on keeping and retaining some really good resilient seed stock, then we've got that legacy to pass on to the next generation.
Fascinating. Now, you've got a huge garlic in here. I mean, it's massive. One of the cloves is as big as a bulb you'd see in the supermarket.
Yeah, yeah.
How
absolutely.
Do you get them that big?
Oh, well, that variety is actually elephant garlic. So it's actually more like a leek in flavour and texture. But again, it's just been years of growing and selecting the best and then looking for the traits that we want. And so we are farming for a trait that is a low input, easy to grow, and then by keep selecting the biggest, most resilient bulbs and the ones that keep really well, you can keep improving year on year on year. So this is both these, like when you're looking at the potatoes and this Rioja garlic, which is still pretty good size for an average bit of garlic, you know, there's kind of 10 years of us kind of working on that improvement through there.
So what's your target market for the produce that you grow?
We're just small scale. We just sell to restaurants. We're not wanting to compete with the market gardeners that are doing the high value, high turnover beets, carrots, lettuces, radishes. That's kind of not where we're at. We're just growing a small selection of speciality veggies and just trialling a few that we can hopefully harvest for many years.
Now, behind us is a tool shed that you've constructed, and it looks very organised.
I guess when it comes to what we're doing on the farm, we've got to be super efficient. And this is kind of goes back, I don't know if you know much about like lean manufacturing. There's kind of a lean farming leg of that, which looks at basically how you can make super efficient what you're doing to actually be profitable at a small scale. And so having things organised in a place where you know where they are and know where to find them is really important. And that's why the other reason the shed's right here, a metre away from the garden, so we don't have to traipse over to a shed 100 metres away and drag tools back across.
Yes. So what is your philosophy about the land? What sort of approach do you have towards farming?
It's a really difficult one to answer because I don't think we should be trying to pigeonhole ourselves into certain aspects. I think if we try and say I'm A, B or C
yep.
farmer, we may shut ourselves off to particular tools that are actually going to be beneficial for us. So I've been fortunate enough to have a lot of experience with a lot of different people, from a permaculture, from organic to biodynamic recently, and then from you know, the term regenerative agriculture. Is funny, you know, 3 years ago I could use that term and nobody knew what I was talking about, so I'd kind of stop saying it. and it's really cool that it has become way more mainstream now, so that's really good. And you could say, like, the core principles of regenerative agriculture, which are based on soil health, you know, I'd certainly abide by those. But really kind of our overarching philosophy is looking at the whole farm as one organism. And that includes the farmer, the livestock and the plants.
Mm. What have been some of the biggest challenges so far in terms of developing this land?
Probably our time, to be perfectly honest. When you're starting out on something, I guess I should go back a step. You know, we're starting not only a farm but a business and wanting to build a home here as well. So there's a number of things that are coming into play. And so it's trying to be really clear on your priorities. And it's been difficult to discern what some of those are when you've got the day-to-day aspects of managing livestock in quite intensive fashion like we are, and then trying to get some cash flow from the garden, because that kind of cash flows is a bit quicker than, say, what some of the livestock do. And so, yeah, time and being really clear on what our priorities are is probably the hardest part of that.
Mm. Shall we wander down the hill and have a look at some of your animals?
Yeah, sure.
Tell me about your puppy.
So this is Em. We got her just about 6 weeks ago. She's a border collie cross-heading dog. And yeah, we've got kind of high hopes. Rish will be able to help us with some of the livestock. But the other thing is I'm diabetic and we're on the way to training to be able to sense when my blood sugars go either low or high, so she can indicate to me when I need to do something about that. So that'll be really cool if we can manage to get there. And I think, I think we're on the right track with it so far.
I like him. Now, what are you carrying?
I'm carrying a Wee Solar Energizer, which we use for our temporary electric fencing with the livestock. And so I'd one of our cheeky little goats had chewed through that just last night. So that's my bad for leaving it where I shouldn't have done. And so I've just had it back up at the shed repairing it earlier. And so we'll go down and put a bit more power in this fence to make sure they don't kind of push through. But by and large, most of the stock are well trained to it and respect it pretty well.
Now we've crossed the paddock and come into the shade of the trees, and it's a lot colder, isn't it, when we're out of the sun?
It is.
Whoops.
It is.
You okay?
Yeah.
Thank you. Just climbing over a fence. Oh, and there's some rusty barbed wire there. Oh.
Here.
On the other side of the shelter belt. Yeah, that's fine. It's a very steep paddock, and it's a bit of a sun trap here, isn't it?
Yes, this is actually quite neat. We're kind of westerly facing here, so we've got a real neat view from up here over the Hurunui River Valley down there, and it's nice to see actually a bit of green not only on the plains but on the terraces too.
We can see the river there, which I guess is running super high.
Yeah, absolutely, and it probably will be for a wee bit to come.
Were you able to get over the bridge earlier this week?
Yeah, we were pretty fortunate, but it was as high as I've ever seen it. It was almost to the underside of the state highway bridge there. Phenomenal amount of flow. I wouldn't like to estimate what the flow was, but yeah, it was a milky torrent, that's for sure.
At the bottom of the hill, we can see some belted galloways, some sheep, some other cattle, and in the distance, sheep are dotted over the steep, shady hills.
Yep. So our boundary is just down at the bottom here. So these Belties and the other black cows within the low-lying Anguses, they're ours. And then we've got a mixture of sheep breeds. We're still trying to work out what's going to work best for us on the landscape. I was pretty keen to start off with Wiltshires, or at least shedding sheep. Not a big fan of needing or wanting to shear. But yeah, we're just not quite finding their sizing up quite the same as some of the other breeds that we've got around. So we'll still try and persevere with them maybe, but we'll just see how we go. But the Belted Galloways and the low-lying Angus have been really good for our landscape because we are reasonably hilly here and parts of the farm have fragile soils on. We were quite keen to focus in on traits that are desirable for this type of landscape. So that's animals with short legs and a bit of a lighter frame. And I've got to say those Belties have been a real surprise to us. They're a bit of a nostalgia. You know, I don't know if you know much about the Belted Galloway originating in southwestern Scotland in an area with quite high rainfall and certainly lower summer temperatures than what we get here. But they've been really exceptional and just really, really good-natured.
And do they have a nice marbled meat?
They do. We haven't actually harvested any one of our Belties yet. We were due to last week, but because of the rains, we couldn't get out. But yeah. But I've heard from the butcher and other people that, yeah, generally, if you've got a Beltie that gets beyond that 2.5 years old, they really start to build that marbling. So we're hoping that there'll be a real special eating experience. And even the low-lying Anguses that we've had to date, they've been, yeah, really unique taste. And I'm not sure, we kind of feel that might be down to the fat layer, and because we're on kind of our forage is quite diverse, but we've got some areas in the forest where they eat a bit of bush and just a multitude of different things that they're eating. So I think that diversity in the diet's really adding to a uniqueness in the taste and the texture.
We've come down to the bottom of the hill and a small flock of sheep are surrounding us.
Yep. Because of the dry weather, we've probably got rid of more than half our ewes, and have only got a few ewe lambs left from this season left in the flock, one for the quality of feed. So we'll try and cull fairly hard as well. So there's still a few in here that I want to get rid of that don't look so neat, that, you know, I'll have like a wee bit of a any kind of sign of dagging or just not holding good body condition, then we'll flick them on, because we need to keep animals that are actually going to work in with our management style. And there's, you know, we don't use any kind of commercial drenches. We use kind of some more organic based ones, but you know, there's still time and energy even into that that we're not really wanting to do. So we want some low maintenance, easy care ewes that can hopefully produce decent lambs that we can start getting some money from eating.
And you're quite fortunate, because about 5 km down the road, closer towards the Hurunui River, is the Harris Meats Abattoir.
Yep. So the Harris Meats Abattoir is really one of the reasons why we ended up in landing in this spot, because we knew we wanted to do something with animal protein, and just knowing that those last few hours and moments of an animal's life has a really big impact on the quality of the eating experience, that we wanted to be able to manage that as closely as possible right to the end, because, you know, we put a lot of time and energy into managing our whole flock for, well, the cows could be, you know, 2 to 2.5 years. And so we want those last moments to be really, you know, as least disturbing for them as possible, so you don't have that adrenaline and cortisol running through the body. So we're really fortunate. We've got our own stock trailer. I can take the stock down there myself on the morning that they're going to be culled. They're only in the yards for a short period of time before they're taken through. And Harris's as well have kind of got a really neat philosophy and have done some work with Temple Grandin to really understand low stress animal handling techniques, which is really important for us.
Phil's just opened a gate and he's about to move the mob into the lower paddock. And there's a few stragglers running down from the top of the hill.
We'll just wander around this way then.
Do you live part of the time in town and the rest of the time here? How does it work?
Yeah, correct. So kind of I try and split my time 50-50-ish between the farm and the town, so in Christchurch.
What do you do in town?
So I work generally on construction projects, doing project management and consultancy services. I actually kind of really like the juxtaposition of the, I guess, the social side of the work we do in town versus, I guess, it's a wee bit more solitary up here. We've got some pretty good neighbours, but by and large, what you're doing in terms of the work's your own responsibility and down to yourself what you're gonna get done or not.
Yes. Now, Em, your dog, has been poking her head through my legs, hiding, I guess, from a steer that's been chasing her around the paddock.
Yeah, well, I think they're kind of intrigued, aren't they, with her still. She's still kind of, obviously, she's quite new with us, and it's actually quite nice that she's almost a little bit afraid of some of the bigger stocks, so she's not going to be aggressive or anything like that. But no, it's kind of, I think she'll have a good life, and she'll make a good dog once she gets a wee bit more confident around the stock.
Where are you from originally, Phil, and where does your interest in farming come from?
So I'm originally from Yorkshire in England, and we grew up in quite a rural area, just a little village. We did have a little small holding over there, a couple of acres is what we grew up on, but my dad only really just grew vegetables, and we had a few chickens, and I'd not actually really interacted with livestock long before as kind of getting the farm. And so I'm definitely not experienced in farming. I haven't had any formal agricultural training, but kind of sparked an interest in just terms of wanting to live a relatively low impact life, and then just having a thirst for knowledge around it just really interested me. And then the more I found out, the more I thought, blimey, you know, you can do some really good things with livestock and grasses in terms of improving landscapes, having massive impacts on water quality, and even to the extent of reducing the impact of climate change. So there's massive potential with how we manage land, and probably the only way we'll kind of be a more resilient world for a long time to come will be focusing on land management.
And how did you end up here in New Zealand?
Love, like I guess like most people end up the halfway around the world. So I met Catherine where I'm working back in the UK over 10 years ago, and she was coming to the end of her ancestry visa, so she'd spent about 5 years over there. And so, yeah, I convinced her to let me come back with you.
And the rest is history.
It is.
Phil Varley talking to Cosmo near Cheviot in North Canterbury.